From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. The Russian media are doing some soul-searching this week. In a news story with characters, subplots, and subterfuge worthy of Tolstoy, Russia's only independent television network, NTV, was taken over by the gas company. After defaulting on a massive loan, Vladimir Gazinsky seems to have lost control of his media-most empire. It is in the hands of the receivers in this case being the state-run Gazprom. Journalists at the station staged a sit-in for 11 days to protest the new owner. By the time Gazprom's private security forces entered the offices, many of the journalists had resigned and set up shop at a cable station also principally owned by Gazinsky. Michael Wines is in the New York Times Bureau in Moscow, and he joins us on the line. Welcome to On the Media, Michael.
My pleasure.
Is there any chance that Gazprom will come in and actually be an honest broker here and let NTV be a Western-style broadcast station that asks tough questions of political leaders?
Well, Gazprom has been running NTV for the last, 4 days, and I think the consensus is that so far they've been fairly objective. You know, they haven't gone out and beaten the world with stories critical of the Kremlin, but neither have they kowtowed to it. There's an American who's running the station now named Boris Jordan, who has made a public pledge that the station will be immune from political or shareholder influence. And so far, that seems to be true. I think the big question is what happens when Mr. Jordan leaves, as he must. Because, I mean, let's face it, Gazprom is a company that is 38.4% owned by the Kremlin. Its links to the Russian government are deep and inextricable. It's almost a part of the state.
It's possible that Mr. Gazinsky is both a Democrat fighting for an independent voice and a financial fraud as well, isn't it?
Mr. Gazinsky is a very charismatic and bright leader. He has run an excellent media operation on largely Western standards. It's by far the best, I think, among the major media in Russia. But in the last 4 or 5 years, he too has used it to try to influence the state, to try to advance his business interests. So, you know, he's not exactly a complete white knight in this.
Is it too early to tell how the Russian people are viewing this whole situation? Who do you suppose, in the public's eye, has the moral authority at this point?
There have been some polls on this and some experts who have looked at it. Roughly 9 out of 10 Russians really don't care about this. Or they think Mr. Gazinsky, who was a very wealthy man who got rich during the 1990s when the majority of Russians were either losing their jobs or starving, they think that that he deserves whatever he gets. You have another 10% of Russians, mostly the intellectual elite, the pro-Western liberals, who think this is an extremely important issue. And there have been some very large and vocal demonstrations in support of NTV and Mr. Gazinsky. But I think once you get outside of Moscow, you really don't find much support.
So if democracy itself is at stake in this battle, the public doesn't seem much to notice or care.
Well, first you have to ask the question whether democracy is at stake. There's a tendency, I think, to try to look at this situation through an American mirror because we've been in democracy for 200 years and say, well, they ought to be doing this. But you have to look at it through Russian eyes. This is a place that is really still toying with the idea of what it ought to be. They've seen democracy on television or they've read about it in magazines, and they know that they want a certain amount of freedom, but there's a deep suspicion of the uncertainty that comes with the sorts of freedoms that Americans are used to.
How about a 5-part series on NTV, Corruption in the Kremlin? We expect to see that anytime soon?
You know, the thing about this country is you can slam Gazinsky and you can slam Gazprom and you can be right on both. But in this country right now, everybody's guilty. You have to give Mr. Gazinsky credit for one thing. This guy built an entire empire, which for better or worse, you know, has had a real impact on this country and has introduced the idea of Western-style media to it. So, you know, he'll leave a legacy no matter what happens.
And he'll get to enjoy that idea from somewhere in Spain.
Well, it sure looks like that for the moment.
All right. Michael Wines, thanks very much for joining us.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Michael Wines is in the Moscow Bureau of the New York Times.
Timothy McVeigh, architect of the Oklahoma City bombing, will die by lethal injection on May 16th, Barring a last-minute stay, his will be the first federal execution to be given the go-ahead since 1963. Already, the media circus is pitching its tent in Terre Haute, Indiana, where McVeigh is being held, and that's what's worrying Attorney General John Ashcroft. Anticipating blanket coverage of the event, the Attorney General has moved to limit press access. Barbara Cochran, president of the Radio Television News Directors Association, protested the restrictions in an open letter. Barbara Cochran, thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Brooke. It's great to be here.
So what are the details of the restrictions?
Well, for one thing, General Ashcroft said that he would forbid any television interviews, which rules out an entire medium, and of course we objected to that. Secondly, he said that McVeigh would be limited to 15 minutes a day to use the telephone, and he could presumably call news organizations and do interviews during that time. But General Ashcroft also asked that the reporters voluntarily refrain from recording those interviews. And again, that would also inhibit people who practice electronic journalism without being able to use McVeigh's own words as he speaks them.
Actually, what Ashcroft said was something to the effect of he was asking the press not to be co-conspirators with McVeigh in his assault on America by giving a mass murderer access to the public podium. What do you think about that?
Well, I think it's an entirely out-of-bounds suggestion for someone who is a government official, who is the chief law enforcement officer of our country. And, of course, his words carry very strong weight, and it is precisely because he is a government official attempting to define what is and is not news that we objected.
You suggested in your letter to Mr. Ashcroft, your actions, which place severe limitations on how a particular individual may comment to reporters, and thus the public, present complex problems and raise significant constitutional concerns. What about the Constitution? Does the Supreme Court sanction his decision?
Not particularly. I mean, the only reasons that a government official would have for limiting access would be security and the orderly administration of justice. And instead, General Ashcroft said that it's a matter of taste.
Let's pursue that issue for a second, then. How much information does the public actually need? Why do we need to see pictures of his final days and hear from him before his execution?
The death penalty is the most serious sanction that the government can take against one of its citizens, and the public has had access to this case right straight along. It seems fitting that they should continue to at least be allowed to hear the thoughts of McVeigh in his final days if he chooses to do interviews.
Currently, it looks as if the execution itself will be broadcast on closed-circuit television just for the victims' families and other interested parties. Do you think it should be broadcast for the general public?
We think that there is a legal right to do so, but that it, as a matter of editorial discretion, it's very unlikely that anyone would use it.
Have you had any response from the Attorney General's office to your letter?
No. I think the important thing here was not that we necessarily thought that he would change his mind in retrospect, but it was to highlight the fact that it's not in the interest of anyone to have access to the public podium be controlled by government officials.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Barbara Cochran is the president of the Radio and Television News Directors Association.
In our ongoing feature, Word Watch, we track the rise of a word's popularity in public discourse and its use and abuse in the media. This week, we're taking a different approach. Instead of examining the way newscasters and reporters use a word, On the Media's Dave Sirchuk considers how they say it.
Gentlemen, my name is Dr. Evil. In a little while, you'll notice that the Kreblakistani warhead has gone missing. If you want it back, you're going to have to pay me $1 million. Sorry. $100 billion.
Gentlemen, silence. While Dr. Evil may have failed to take over the world in Austin Powers' International Man of Mystery, he just may have influenced the strong emphasis some anchors place on the word billion. Or should I say, billion.
I think newscasters are secretly watching Dr. Evil behind closed doors.
Renee Falcone is the assistant director for the Connecticut School of Broadcasting in Farmingdale, Connecticut. If what Falcone says is true, then there's a lot of tribute to Dr. Evil on CNN-FN. On the March 12th episode of Moneyline, there were at least two instances of billion from just the first 30 minutes of the show.
208. Volume was over 1.2 billion shares. We will take an in-depth look.
Of course, Moneyline deals with big money, in addition to big stock transactions.
In other corporate news tonight, the largest insurance deal in history, UK-based Prudential, no relation to the U.S. insurer, offering more than $26 billion in stock for American General.
Ida Olson, a New York-based speech-language pathologist, said newscasters emphasize billion this way in order to get attention-depleted viewers to listen up and notice what they're putting across.
When you're dealing with a professional individual and you're trying to get them to improve their speech, most of what they have to do is sell. And so you want to get them to use a varied intonation. Maybe we need a little bit more hype in our news to get people to watch. I think it adds excitement. I think the attempt is to add excitement anyway.
To thrill people with finance?
A billion is a lot, at least to me.
Renee Falcone adds that in her classes, potential anchors have emphasized billion without being instructed to do so. She says that some anchors may have picked up billion and its mini-me, million, from Dr. Evil, or more likely, from other newscasters.
I think it's subconscious because I don't think people can, like, properly say it anymore. Those that are wanting to do newscasting, they, when they're doing a story regarding the market or national funds, things like that, they can't say million the normal way. Even though they're trying to be very professional, matter-of-fact, and authoritative in their newscast, they have to inflect on the million or the billion.
And do you do it?
I do it. I'm a victim of $1 billion.
Oh, behave. For On the Media, I'm David Sirchuk.
Coming up, Jets, Lies, and Videotape. Also, TV news magazines charged with racial discrimination in how they cast their stories.
This is On the Media from National Public Radio.
Welcome back to On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Since the collision of the U.S. spy plane and a Chinese fighter jet early this month, talks between the two nations over who is wrong have come to nothing. This week, the battle for hearts and minds was waged with video. The Pentagon lodged the first salvo, a video of an encounter 3 months ago between U.S. and Chinese aircraft near the China coast.
How far are we?
One's right there. 10 o'clock. We're going to pass in front of
us. Going right in front of us. Same altitude. All right. Hey, we got bumped.
Felt that one.
We got bumped.
The latest Time magazine called the video chilling. The Chinese jet was hot-dogging and harassing the American aircraft, observes Time, flying on the very edge of controllability. The Pentagon said it was the same jet, maybe even the same pilot, who vanished over the Chinese sea in the recent collision. Last week on NBC's Meet the Press, host Tim Russert showed the film to one of the U.S. crewmen recently returned from China.
But that's the same exact aircraft that harassed and ultimately rammed into you, correct? I don't think it's the same aircraft, and I'm not sure whether the same person was flying it. That's not information that I have.
Lieutenant Honick was off the script. He said he didn't think it was the same plane. Rick MacArthur, author of Second Front, Censorship and Propaganda in the Gulf War, says the media should exercise the same caution as Lieutenant Honick. After all, he says, this Bush administration includes many of the same officials who marshaled the media during Desert Storm. During the Gulf War, when the American public became concerned by pictures of Scud missiles fired by Iraq into Israel, General Norman Schwarzkopf showed a reassuring video of Scud launchers blown up by American precision bombs. Later, it turned out they were not Scud launchers. They were
trucks, nothing more than trucks. That was strictly public relations, and when I think about that, I'm reminded that what we're dealing with here in the new Bush administration is top-shelf public relations talent. You're not talking about amateurs here. These people know how to change the subject. If the subject is Scuds hitting Israel and people are hysterical, we'll blow up some mobile Scud launchers. If the issue is American or perceived American recklessness towards China by spying on them in the first place, then the Chinese pilot becomes reckless, and here's the video to back it up.
Never underestimate the power of video, says MacArthur.
You can't contradict pictures. That proves it. Case closed. And an alarming number of newspaper reporters, television reporters, and then the American public will walk away from it saying, yeah, well, the Chinese have been doing this for months. They're reckless. And that becomes a kind of a mantra, a public relations mantra.
I think they've done a brilliant job in steering the issue to why one plane collided with another plane.
Edward J. Epstein is author of Deception, the Invisible War Between the KGB and the CIA, and News from Nowhere.
They treat it as if there's an auto accident on the New Jersey Turnpike, and which driver was at fault, as opposed to the issue which they're trying to evade, and that is the issue of what this plane's mission was and what kind of information it gathers.
This week, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld took pains to tell the media that the Navy's EP-3 Ares II, now held by the Chinese, is a surveillance plane, not a spy plane. But the distinction appears to be academic. Edward J. Epstein.
The primary mission of the EP-3 Ares is electronic warfare. That's what it was built for, to gather together signals intelligence, keep a library of it. In terms of how it builds its library, the library is all the radar frequencies and microwave frequencies that can be used against our planes or ships.
And so, when this plane is flying around, what exactly is it trying to do?
It's trying to provoke and light up the radar of a potential enemy.
He says the Pentagon video has diverted the news media to a safer area of inquiry.
You've made the question a question of who caused the traffic accident, as opposed to the other question of are such accidents inevitable if you're flying on a mission whose purpose it is to evoke radar responses and defense responses.
And there's another question we should be asking, says Rick MacArthur. Is American technical competence really as infallible as the Pentagon tells us it is?
All our bombs hit their targets. We don't use dumb bombs. We only use smart bombs. Other countries are reckless. Other pilots are reckless. Our pilots don't make mistakes. That's a manipulation of public opinion that is a real subversion of the democratic process. And to the extent that the media go along with it and report it straight without much skepticism is bad for the country.
MacArthur says the press and the public should be on their guard. After all, the 1997 movie Wag the Dog does suggest that in some areas, at least, American technical prowess is genuinely unimpeachable.
You watch the Gulf War. What do you see day after day? The one smart bomb falling down a chimney. The truth? I was in the building when we shot that shot. We shot it in a studio, Falls Church, Virginia, 1/10 scale model of a building.
Is that true?
How do we know? You take my point?
Yes.
The collision off the China coast may have unfolded precisely as the Pentagon says. But how do we know? This week, a dissenting view of the event came not surprisingly from China. It released a video intended to demonstrate that pilots of American spy planes are reckless, and it offered an animated reenactment of this month's accident to show America at fault. The Pentagon dismissed the Chinese video as unconvincing and the animation as a cartoon. But just to be on the safe side, it promptly released one of its own, with much higher production values, including convincing little clouds, apparently unavailable to the Chinese.
As part of the research for a handbook for television journalists, more than 100 television executives, reporters, and producers sat down with TV news veteran Av Weston. Because of Weston's good reputation after nearly 50 years in the news business, and because the participants were all off the record, they said some amazing things, specifically on the topic of race. An article in the April issue of Brill's Content magazine documents his findings. Av Weston, welcome to On the Media.
Delighted to be here.
When a black face is about to be photographed, does everything change in the making of television news?
I think steps are taken so that black faces aren't photographed at all, and therefore you don't have to make that decision in terms of whether the piece gets changed or not. Now, mind you, when I talk to the management of these programs and to the management of the news divisions themselves, they deny fervently that race is a factor. They're adamant about it. And yet, in interviewing 137 people at all ranks, as soon as you got down below the senior producer level and started talking to the troops, they would tell me story after story about how blacks were rejected either as the grist for a story or essentially rejected as being part of the cast of the story. That is, who is the expert that you get to comment? Who is the family that you get to be the exemplar of whatever story you're doing?
All right, let me see if I got this right. Let's say I'm a producer for a news magazine, and I'm producing a piece about arsenic in drinking water. And I find a family in a town where there's a high level of arsenic in drinking water, and they happen to be black. What happens?
It will be suggested to you that since whites also are drinking the arsenic-laden water, that go find a white family. Example, one young woman told me that a network, and I'm going to preserve their anonymity, so I'm not going to mention which network, nor am I going to be specific enough so that retribution could land upon the shoulders of this person. She told me that this network was going to do a one-hour special about a pediatric disease, and she was told to go out and find a family and a child and all of the component parts, and she did. When she revealed, however, that the family was black, she was told, look, other people have this disease, white people have this disease, go back and find a white family, and she did.
Now, let us presume and let us hope to God that this isn't because the executive producer of whatever this news magazine is so nakedly racist that he just doesn't want to have black faces on his air. There's
none of them are. I know them all.
All right. So what's behind this?
In the past 10 years, minute-by-minute ratings became available to producers, and they were never available before. And there has been a direct interpretation on the part of some of these people that blacks don't get us the ratings. And so if blacks don't get us the ratings, the word gets passed. Now, it doesn't get passed explicitly.
No memos, no paper trail.
No, what happens is this. It's much more subtle. As somebody said, who is an observer of it from the inside, look, a story involving blacks is unlikely to get approved. If it does get improved, it's going to get done, and it's going to sit on the shelf, and we'll have much more difficult time getting broadcast. Now, I asked a lot of the young people why it mattered to them. Why didn't they continue to suggest stories? And they said, look, our jobs, or I should say our performance ratings, and therefore our jobs, depend on the degree to which the stories we suggest are accepted and are produced and are broadcast.
Do you know Neil Shapiro from Dateline and Don Hewitt from 60 Minutes?
Oh, yeah.
All right. They have claimed up and down that it's simply not true.
That's right.
But have any of these people kind of taken you aside, winked at you, and said, look, you know, what am I going to do? I've got to make my number.
No, it didn't come that way. I had a conversation with somebody, and not in Neil's shop, but somewhere else. Oh, by the way, I told Neil that I found this problem at his shop, as well as 2020, as well as... The only place I didn't find it, by the way, was 60 Minutes.
Mr. Hewitt says he never looks at the minute-by-minute ratings. Why is he insulated from the necessity to do that when the other news magazines feel that they must?
60 Minutes essentially faces no competition. It does not have to worry about a cop show on one side, a hospital show on the other, It essentially is the dominant factor at 7 to 8 for that audience.
It's been a dozen years since you were executive producer of 2020 on ABC. Put yourself, though, in that job in the year 2001, and now you're facing the ratings pressures and the bottom line pressures that were much less severe in your day. What do you do?
It would be easy to say that based on all of those years of experience and the gray hairs and the heritage that presumably I brought from starting out working for Murrow, that I would stand up and say, no way is this going to happen. And you can do it to a degree. But the truth is that the business has become the business. Eventually, it gets you.
Av Weston, thank you very much. Appreciate you joining us.
A pleasure to be here. I hope what I've had to say will be provocative, and maybe some responses will occur at television stations, and maybe there'll even be a ripple at one of the news magazines. Who knows?
Av Weston, 6-time Emmy, 4-time Peabody Award winner, and author of The Best Practices for Television Journalism. We asked all the networks to comment on Av Weston's allegations. CBS declined, but news executives at ABC and NBC agreed to talk to us. Joining me first is Victor Neufeld, the senior executive producer of news magazines at ABC. Mr. Neufeld, you heard what Av Weston had to say. What do you think of his allegations?
It's totally ludicrous. There's nothing even close to that. It's ludicrous. It's silly.
You know, Av Weston told me that his research on this subject, and admittedly anecdotal, he didn't audit anybody, but he did talk to 137 people in the news business, and he said, well, he started asking this question when he first encountered it at 2020.
You're assuming that because there's no documentation, you have to make an assumption that he actually spoke to all those people. You have to make an assumption that all those people said all those things.
Well, he spoke to that number of people. He didn't tell me that 137 people said this, but some substantial number of people, maybe it was 10 or 12, started talking about this business of, you know, which is a story casting redlining, basically. Can we go backwards a little bit for just a moment? Evidently, there was at ABC News a handbook put together to help producers find more Black and Latino experts when an expert interview was required. Do you have such a thing?
You know, I heard about it. I think it's around somewhere, but
is anyone using it? Someone told Av Weston that it was, quote, a place to rest your coffee cup.
I don't know what happened to that. I heard about it once. You know, this is a very important subject and a very crucial subject in what we do and an issue. It is so upsetting and outrageous and ludicrous that this issue is seriously considered by you as an issue. These conversations never happen. Just think of it logically. Minority viewers are a major part of our viewership. How stupid it would be, how idiotic it would be to even discuss it as something that's a good thing to have or a positive. I mean, it doesn't make sense.
What if your ratings were dipping every time some Black face came on when a white face would have served?
Think about the logic of that. You think ratings dip and go up based on a face that appears on a screen? It's fantasy.
Tell me about the minute-by-minute ratings. Aren't you able to determine how your audience is reacting minute-by-minute during a broadcast?
Well, your assumptions are it's just too conspiratorial. You know, whether we have minute-by-minute ratings and how we make judgments are not that precise and not even and nowhere near that diabolical.
Victor Neufeld, thank you for joining us.
You're quite welcome.
Victor Neufeld is the senior executive producer of news magazines at ABC. In the interest of full disclosure, ABC News is one of my three media employers, in addition to Advertising Age and, of course, On the Media. Neil Shapiro is executive producer of Dateline NBC. He joins me now. Mr. Shapiro, is there any truth to Av Weston's charges?
You know, I hope not. I mean, I have a great deal of respect for Av. He's a friend of mine. And I know part of his research came out of speaking to people anecdotally. So I'm discouraged to know that anybody on my show would think that. And since I've spoken to Av, I even had staff meetings and reiterated one more time that I want diversity in all aspects of the show. And I'm doing my best I can to try to say very explicitly, it's not what we want to do.
Well, you've got the ability to track stories minute by minute.
Mm-hmm.
Whether you're doing a story about, and I'm coming from your story list, amnesia or botched surgeries or sleeping on the job or ovarian cysts or kids with too heavy backpacks, we react to people most like ourselves. And if the audience is mostly white, inclined to react best to interviewees most like themselves. And with your minute-to-minute ratings, you should probably be able to see that.
I'm not sure that's true because I've never looked at it that way. I'm not sure I even believe that. I mean, most Americans are not serial killers. They don't feel comfortable with serial killers, but they watch serial killers. Most Americans don't have conjoined twins, but they're fascinated by the issue and will watch it. On the other hand, some of the least successful shows, there was a show at NBC News called Real Life. And the premise of the show was, let's just experience the kind of real life stories that we go through, people like us. And it was a disaster, because that's not what people want to watch.
Well, where do you think this criticism is coming from, then? Why is Ive Weston being told the things that he's being told, which sound quite explosive on the face of it?
The fact that some people may feel that disturbs me, and that's why I spoke to them about it. But I don't think it certainly does not reflect the attitude of the people who run the show. Now, I say no to a lot of stories, and I think sometimes people wonder why I say no, or are trying to figure out why I say no to things.
You mean if you've been told no for a story that you are quite fond of, you start looking for reasons elsewhere?
I even try to tell people. We have meetings. I send people, or my seniors, send people computer messages about, here's why we said no to this story. Anyway, all I know is, in the past week, I just thought about the stories I've screened, one of which is a story about a woman who gives a kidney to somebody else. And it turns out that she's black. She's a black teacher, and he's a white student, or the other way around. One is a story about somebody undergoing diabetes treatment, and one of the women undergoing it is African-American. There are like three or four stories I looked at where they're just stories, and some of the characters happen to be African-American.
Well, I know what we're going to do. We're going to start taping Dateline NBC and ABC's 2020 and 48 Hours, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And we're going to do an audit and try to figure out whether the evidence of the next few months' shows supports Ive Weston's charges. Are you going to do anything like that yourself?
You know, I didn't do it, but there was a diversity council here at NBC News, and they have at times just taken a certain group of time, looked at all the shows within NBC, and done just precisely what you said, evaluated who's on. And we generally come out pretty well in that. But, you know, having spoken out, I've done some looking myself. I haven't done it in a systematic way enough that I want to talk about it.
All right. Well, Neil Shapiro, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Neil Shapiro is the executive producer of Dateline NBC.
Coming up, Don Hewitt tells his story, Bat Boy sings his. This is On the Media from National Public Radio.
Welcome back to On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Don Hewitt is a 78-year-old college dropout who made good. So good, in fact, that he's been able to produce the nation's first and arguably best TV news magazine for all of 33 years, with the same people and the same freedom and the same Sunday time slot. As the media business convulses and converges all around him, Don Hewitt and 60 Minutes endure. He's just written a memoir of his life and 60 Minutes called Tell Me a Story. Mr. Hewitt, after you've exposed hundreds of cases of government malfeasance, dozens if not hundreds of cases of falsely accused convicts, hundreds of cases of illegal and unethical business practices, why does anyone sit down for a 60 Minutes interview anymore?
Morley Safer and I were once in Philadelphia speaking at some meeting, and one of the questions from the audience was your question. why does a guy who is obviously a crook decide to go on 60 Minutes? And Morley said, because a crook doesn't believe he's made it as a crook until he's been on 60 Minutes.
You use the tightest close-ups on television.
No more.
No more?
No, it's getting to be a cliche, and I don't like cliches. And I think, in fact, just the other day, I told the guys, pull back a little. We're working too big. We did the Moroccan princess, who was held as a prisoner by the King of Morocco. Great story, but I thought we shot it too tight. Her face was bleeding out of the screen. No, we got to stop that.
You got lots of pores on 60 Minutes on any given evening.
Yeah, no question about it.
Right at the beginning of your book, you lay out your political positions on everything from race relations to same-sex marriage to gun control to God, not to mention your entire voting record over the last three decades.
Right,
now,
right.
I applaud that, and I think it's really interesting because your colleague Dan Rather recently got into some hot water by appearing accidentally, he said, at a Democratic fundraiser. Now, one ethicist we spoke to about that situation says it hurts press credibility to reveal your political stripes. I take it you don't agree.
No, I'm an open book. Why shouldn't I be as open as the people we go after? Look, I have finally decided that there are two words that I would like to see expunged from the lexicon. It's liberal and conservative. I have no idea what they mean.
You've said that behind every magazine show is a failed sitcom.
With one exception.
Mm-hmm.
Because we started it.
That's
but
right.
Then the rest of them came along and they... If those sitcoms hadn't died, there wouldn't have been those magazines.
And you've also said that there isn't enough news for the number of news magazines. Don, you're the father of the genre. Shouldn't you be more nurturing?
I would if they were using them as news magazines and not as filler.
Summarize what you think is the problem with a lot of the news magazines that followed 60 Minutes.
Well, it's the same thing that's wrong with most television. They're in a game. It's called Sweeps Week Roulette. My favorite sweeps week was the week that WCBS actually did Dangerous Dry Cleaners. I'm telling you, Saturday Night Live couldn't have dreamed up anything funnier than that. And it's all nonsense. And the problem really is you can't really compare us to newspapers. Newspaper publishers are in the newspaper business. Broadcast companies are in the entertainment business, and news is a very small part of what they think about, what they care about. And if a broadcast comes along like 60 Minutes and it makes some money like it's going out of style, well, then they pay attention to you and you become somebody around there. If you don't, you're filler. When I started 60 Minutes, I worked for a marvelous man named Bill Leonard, who said to me, "Make us proud." I don't think anybody in television has said to anyone else in television in the last 30, 40 years, make us proud.
Have you made any concession to demographics to try and get a younger audience?
No. No, I don't know what the demographics are. I've never seen a demographic breakdown. I've never seen one of those minute-by-minute Nielsen things that tells you where it peaks and where it goes up and down. I don't want to look at it. The trick in this business is to recognize that there is a line that separates news biz from show biz. And the trick is to walk up to that line and touch it with your toe, but don't cross it. If you don't go anywhere near it, you lose your audience. If you walk over it, you lose your soul. So you want to find out, where is that line? And how do you know where that line is? I don't know how I know where that line is. I just kind of know it.
You, Mike Wallace, Morley Safer, Andy Rooney, are all in your late 70s and beyond. After you all retire, will the legitimate news magazine go with you?
Remains to be seen. Chairman...
I can't believe you said it remains to be seen. You should be ashamed of yourself.
You happen to be right. You absolutely happen to be right.
Are you like Supreme Court justices? You have to keep working because who knows who they'll appoint after you're gone?
There may be some of that, but mostly it's to feed yourself. I don't want to die in a rowboat. I want to die in a canoe.
Don Hewitt, executive producer of 60 Minutes and author of Tell Me a Story. Thank you very much.
Thank you. This was fun.
The headline read, Bat Boy Found in Cave. The Weekly World News, one of the less respectable supermarket tabloids, ran the story back in 1992. The bat boy it referred to wasn't crouching next to the on-deck circle. It was a half-human, half-vampire that kept popping up. Last year, the paper ran a photo of Bat Boy endorsing Al Gore for president, giving him a love bite on the shoulder, which might explain a few things. And recently, Bat Boy has spent his waking hours playing to sold-out audiences in Bat Boy the Musical at Union Square Theater in New York. On the Media's Alicia Zuckerman reports.
Ah, the Weekly World News, the paper that since 1979 has brought us stories about Bigfoot, space aliens, the Loch Ness Monster, not to mention the three-breasted woman who conveniently married the three-handed baseball player from Venezuela. Bill Sloan used to be an editor at the National Enquirer. His new book is called I Watched a Wild Hog Eat My Baby, a colorful history of the tabloids and their cultural impact. He says Bat Boy's move to the stage is a boon for the folks at the Weekly World News.
I think that the people at Weekly World News are really excited about this because even though Bat Boy is a made-up character, it still lends an aura of respectability to the paper.
Bat Boy is not made up, according to Weekly World News managing editor Lesky Pinson.
Why would we want to do that? The verisimilitude of 47 pages would be thrown away if we tried to run some kind of a crazy, phony story on one page. Well, it's not worth it for us.
I know that's not true. I know that Bat Boy is a creation.
Cynics like Bill Sloan don't rattle Pinson. He insists that his paper's coverage of Bat Boy is very real and very expensive.
You know, we're a little bit different than some news organizations. They say they never pay for their stories. We would never pay for a story, some of them say. You know, but hey, when it's a big picture like the space alien shaking hands with a presidential candidate or the Bat Boy with Al Gore, we're not afraid to go sometimes six figures, maybe eight figures, count both sides of the decimal point for a photograph like that.
I love the Weekly World News.
That's Keith Farley.
I've been a fan since I was in college and first discovered the paper. It's just so rich.
Farley and Brian Fleming wrote the script to Bat Boy, the musical. It all started during the shooting of an independent film in which Farley was starring and Fleming directing.
We were just sitting around the campfire at night after the shoot, drinking beers and making up stories about Bat Boy. But 2 years later, we couldn't have a party or have people over to the house without them asking for Bat Boy songs. We'd written a couple of novelty songs, a couple of little silly ditties about Bat Boy, and people just fell in love with the idea of a Bat Boy who sang.
They started with a small production in Los Angeles. It took off. Now it's the hot new show in New York, with a cast recording made earlier this month. Fittingly for a show whose theme is ripped from the headlines of a tabloid, the opening night party drew such notorious celebrities as Monica Lewinsky, Woody Allen, and Suni Previn. But the show's message, explains Farley, is actually pretty wholesome.
Early on, we played with the idea of a tabloid world for Bat Boy, and there was an early drafts of the show where Bat Boy had a rags-to-riches-to-rags story where he sort of was discovered in a cave and then became this rock star and spiraled out of control. And we just found that it didn't have as much meaning for us, it didn't have as much depth for us as the story of how a bat child would try to fit into society. And he wants to be human, but he's half-beast. I like to say, there's a little Bat Boy inside each of us. The question is, what are you going to do with him?
Farley says the plot is modeled after Greek tragedy. The show is a cautionary tale about scapegoating, acceptance, and personal growth. With the help of a veterinarian's wife and daughter, Bat Boy goes from a feral, demented-looking version of Eddie Munster with fangs and Star Trek-like pointy ears to an articulate and polite, Bible-quoting, ascot-wearing gentleman who goes by the name of Edgar. He learns to speak instead of squeak with the help of BBC language tapes. So in the town of Hope Falls, West Virginia, Bat Boy ends up with a British accent.
I will do your laundry, and I will mow your lawn. Let me file your taxes.
Though racks of the Weekly World News stand in the theater lobby, the musical production of Bat Boy is taken a lot more seriously than its print counterpart. Last year, it pulled down an award from the American Academy of Arts and Letters. But don't think the paper hasn't benefited from the show's success. When Farley and Fleming set out to immortalize Batboy, they had to buy the rights from the Weekly World News. Each time his name and image appear in the paper, so do two little letters, TM. Batboy is trademarked. Can you trademark a real person? There was no TM next to Al Gore's name in that photo op with Batboy. For On the Media in New York, I'm Alicia Zuckerman.
Batboy may be many things, but he is not a nihilist. Nihilism is the belief that all values, religious, political, social, moral, are meaningless. Batboy, on the other hand, not only pays his taxes, he wants to pay yours. No, the quintessential expression of nihilism in pop culture, according to Boston College professor Thomas Hibbs, is Jerry Seinfeld, or so he writes in his book, Shows About Nothing. Thomas Hibbs, welcome to On the Media.
Glad to be with you.
Now, you borrowed your title, Shows About Nothing, from the oft-quoted description of Seinfeld. So then, is Seinfeld a nihilist sitcom?
Yes, I think so. The humor often hinged upon the sort of pointlessness of the lives of these characters, the way in which they saw no ultimate purpose to their life, no way in which relationships, for example, especially marriage, could ever be possible for these characters because they had no larger vision of themselves apart from momentary preferences.
So Putty wears a man fur?
He was strutting around the coffee shop like Stein Erickson.
And of course you find fur morally reprehensible.
Anti-fur. Who has the energy anymore?
If there is a best way of life in a nihilistic world, Jerry seems to have it. Because Jerry seems able to live, with few exceptions, in a very detached way so that he never invests anything emotionally in any other person. And, of course, his sense of humor, which is a way, a kind of detached irony that mocks even the deepest sorts of human longing for love. I mean, there were shows where they made fun of Schindler's List, made fun of AIDS walks, abortion, euthanasia, all the big debates in our society are satirized on that show in a way that that enables Jerry to remain detached and sort of free from any connection to anyone. And I think in a world where there is no purpose or meaning, Jerry's way of going through life represents wisdom, if there is such a thing in that context.
But Mr. Hibbs, the characters in Seinfeld often get their comeuppance through fateful coincidences, and doesn't that suggest that there's a divine plan at work in the cosmos?
You know, if there is a divine plan in Seinfeld, it's a very dark one. When they're about to have their pilot accepted at one point, George is worried the whole show about a discoloration on his lip. And he says, I knew this would happen. I knew God wouldn't have let me enjoy my success. And Jerry says to him, I thought you didn't believe in God. George says, for the bad things I do. Say the episode where Kramer decides to go on the AIDS walk, for example, doing good. And yet he's beaten by the AIDS walkers because he fails to wear the AIDS ribbon. So that in this world, it doesn't seem to matter whether you do good or whether you do bad. In the end, your desires are always frustrated. So it seems to me that it might be justice in the sense that not even the bad get away with anything, but the good is never rewarded on this show either.
What has to be present or missing from a movie or a TV show in order for it to be nihilist?
Well, I think for it to be fully nihilist, in the way I'm suggesting that Seinfeld is, even the quest for happiness and justice and truth and beauty, friendship, love, all those great ideals inspiring the American regime from way back when, all of those things are mocked and seen as pointless.
So what is the ultimate expression or example of nihilism in pop culture, do you think?
When I started with Seinfeld and then said, all right, what are the roots of this? It seems to me another example of this that people wouldn't put together with Seinfeld is or are films like Silence of the Lambs and the recent sequel Hannibal and Pulp Fiction. It seems to me that those films are sort of on the way toward glamorizing evil.
What about it? Why don't you look at yourself and write down what you see? Maybe you're afraid to.
A census taker once tried to test me. I ate his liver with some fava beans and a nice Chianti.
her vision gradually becomes subordinated in Silence of the Lambs to Hannibal's, what I've called, aesthetics of evil. And in the more recent film, Hannibal, her vision is not really a threat to him at all. He becomes the central character, eclipsing any real concern with justice.
What, in your view, is the ultimate impact of nihilistic pop culture?
Pre-teenagers are being fed a large dose of this stuff, and what it does, it seems to me, is to shrink their moral imagination. The problem is not so much imitation. The problem is that children generally lack, if they're brought up in a kind of vacuum where pop culture fills in for that, that then they will not have examples of complex adult struggles with evil, where they see people overcome evil or at least attempt to overcome it, and where that struggle is depicted nobly. And if they don't have those images, stories to draw upon when their own lives get tough, which they do pretty quickly in our society, then my worry is that there might be a kind of despair. I think on the flip side of all that, set aside the negative consequences, it does seem to me that we can learn something from what Hollywood is doing in these films, because it does seem to me that what Hollywood typically does is to take certain assumptions that are just beneath the surface in American society. I mean, there's been talk for the last 10 years at least about the fragmentation of community. Well, what happens if you were to take that fragmentation to its logical extreme? I think what you'd get if you had creative, funny characters living in that world is Seinfeld. What you would get is a kind of universal nihilism. We can all be thankful, I think, that those things haven't been made universal yet in our society.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Thomas Hibbs is a Boston College professor and author of the book Shows About Nothing, which is subtitled, like all good academic works, Nihilism in Popular Culture from The Exorcist to Seinfeld.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price and Katya Rogers, engineered by George Edwards, and edited by Brooke. We had help from David Serchuk, Kathleen Horan, and Dylan Keith.
Mike Pesca is our producer at large, Arun Roth, our senior producer, and Dean Capello, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and get free transcripts at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from National Public Radio. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Funding for On the Media is provided by the Ford Foundation, the Florence and John Schumann Foundation, the Bidell Foundation, the John T. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This program is a production of WNYC Radio New York. This is NPR, National Public Radio.